In one of the suttas, the Buddha gave this very beautiful story. He said these two men, they heard that a certain country, because of some disease or some war, pestilence, they abandoned the towns and the villages there. And so they thought, well, yeah, it's a long way away, but if we go there, we may be able to find something which someone has left there or abandoned. So the two of them went together there, and then they found some hempen thread, which had already been woven into rope. And so one of them thought, well, you know, like, what do you want sort of this hemp for anyway, but to make rope? So he threw down his bundle of hemp and just put the made a bundle of the rope. But the other guy said, no, I've already sort of carried this hemp so far already, I might as well keep the hemp. And so the two of them went along, one had the rope, one had just ordinary hemp. And then after a while they found some cotton. And the one with the rope said, well, cotton's more valuable than rope. He threw away his cotton and threw away the rope and picked up the cotton. The other one said, no, the hemp, this is, I've already carried it so far anyway, and it's okay, I'll just keep that. And as the story went on, they found not just cotton, they found cotton cloth, they found like silk and silk cloth, they found some, copper, and then some silver, and then some gold. And one of the guys, all the time, when he found something better, he threw away the old stuff and took up the better stuff. This old guy was so accustomed to carrying his hemp that when he got back to the village, one of them had a big pile of gold on his head, and the other one just had a big bundle of hemp. Isn't that the case with us? And the Buddha told that story. He said, like, the one of them was very popular with his friends and relations, while the other one got into big trouble. What are you fool for? Just, you had a chance to pick up some gold, which was worth something, and you just carried this bundle of hemp. Isn't it the case with us? That instead of actually changing for something better, we just keep to our old habits, we get accustomed to our old views because we're used to them. Have you ever tried talking to like an old person about changing their views, and they say, no, I'm just too old to change now, I'm just too accustomed to this way of looking at things, too accustomed to change my ways. We all got a bit of that old age in us. It's being stuck. So sometimes we get to, you know, a particular layer of that lotus, and this is good enough for us. Thank you very much, this will do. And we never really get the full benefit of this type of meditation. So you have to be prepared. If you're going to do Satipatthana, if you're going to do insight, if you really want to know the way things truly are, you've got to be prepared to throw away an old bundle of hemp which you've been carrying around for years. You've got to be prepared to throw away the bundle of rope, the bundle of cotton, the bundle of cloth, the copper, the silver, for when you find the gold. If it's something better, something more true, then throw it away. Why keep hanging on to these things? So you have the courage to let go of old ideas, to go one more petal in on the lotus. And that courage is important in Satipatthana. That commitment to truth rather than commitment to comfortable ideas. When you actually focus in there on any of these four things, I was just saying on Vedana, pleasure and pain, the other ones is on the mind, consciousness, you may have some very comfortable ideas of what consciousness is, which you're very used to, you want to preserve. If you have comfortable ideas of what consciousness is, what you are, what God is, what the world is, what anything is, and you're not willing to abandon them, then not much of the lotus will open up. It'll only open up as far as you're comfortable with. You will not be able to see things newly, freshly. And with the mind objects, things like, you know, the willpower, which you can put in front of your mind. What is that? Or any other objects which you can focus on. To actually understand these things. Thought, what is thought? You put that in front of your mind as a mind object. You have to sustain attention on it. without getting involved in it, because if you get involved in thought, then it just carries you away. You've got to stand back as if it's someone else's thinking. Stand back as if you're watching thought on a movie screen. But always remember, you're on a seat. You're not in the movie. You're just standing back watching. Getting that perspective with Satipatthana. Because if you don't get that perspective, you need to dive into the lotus. You just become another leaf in the lotus, and it obstructs the truth. You've got to sort of keep that perspective, standing back. And if you do it with any of these four objects, these four focuses of mindfulness, you sustain your attention on it, there will eventually come a time when you get past your old knowledge. That is the most important stage to sort of get over, because it gives you the courage, it gives you the encouragement, I should have said, to sort of carry on, because this is where it starts getting fun. You start to see things you never expected before. The Dhamma starts to open out. It becomes fascinating. It becomes fresh. It becomes wonderful. Full of wonder. What is wonderful is usually things which are uncommon. Things which you've never seen before. Isn't this amazing? Wow, I never expected this before. I never expected this. This is where the wonder aspect comes into meditation. And so just when you watch the carpet, look at the carpet, it becomes actually wonderful. Wow, I never expected things like that to exist in a carpet or on a leaf on a tree. When you actually do this, it becomes fascinating. Just as in that poem by William Blake, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. Really sort of inspiring, that poem, which I'm sure that some of you have heard of before, because I've said it sort of very often. You haven't actually read it yourself, you've heard it from me. To see a world in a grain of sand, something insignificant, a heaven and a wild flower, you know, wild flowers very small, a whole heaven, just enough bliss in there to keep you happy for eons, in a simple wild flower. And then you get hold infinity in the palm of your hand. Wow, infinity, you know, palm of your hand, right here and now, you've got infinity, endless, boundless, this present moment, an eternity in an hour, timelessness. Wow. See, the whole of existence is opening out to you. A grain of sand is just opening up into a whole world. A little wild flower, a whole heavenly realm is in there. You know, the present moment is infinite. You think it's so small and tiny. That's where infinity lies. And eternity, timelessness, right now. The whole thing opens out, what you never expect. And so, if you can actually get to that wonder stage, then the whole practice of Satipatthana gets really to be fun. Investigation doesn't become a challenge anymore. It becomes an invitation. It becomes, as we chant, Ahipassico, inviting you to come and see. That's in that chant we do every morning and evening. You know, the Suvakata Dhammo Bhagavata Sanditiko Akariko Ahipassiko, inviting you to come and see, inviting inwards. So the Dhamma is actually, once you get past the stage of being afraid of abandoning your old bundle of hemp, then it starts getting really interesting. Wow, I've got some silver now. Wow, some gold. Look at different diamonds over there. Wow, some even more expensive than diamonds. Dhamma. You see all of these things, and it becomes really fascinating and really good fun. So this is why, once you start to sustain attention, you can open up that lotus, and the innermost leaves are the most beautiful. That's why they become fascinating. They become strange and wonderful. They become things which only you can see. It's hard to describe to somebody else. You just don't believe that sort of a carpet can be so wonderful. Instead of using a carpet, I used to talk about concrete, because when I started doing this in Thailand, the sala, the meditation hall, was just at a concrete floor. And you know, we do walking meditation up and down this concrete floor, until, because of samadhi, the concrete floor started to explode into colour and shape, and it became just so beautiful. I never believed that concrete could be so wonderful. And I give that similar very often over in Melbourne once on a talk. And the following day, one of the people who heard this, he was inviting me to dine at his house. And he took me to one of his walls. See that? And he had a bit of old concrete put in a frame and hung it on the wall. He'd heard my talk the night before. He found a bit of old concrete around the back and he framed it. He said, "You're right, it's really beautiful." So instead of going and getting all these expensive prints and Alan Bond's La Promenade and all this sort of stuff, it's cost a fortune, just go and get a bit of old concrete from around the back of your house, frame it, put it on your wall. I'm sure it'll be a conversation piece when you get your friends around. And you say, "Can't you see? It's just so beautiful, so wonderful. You're just on the outermost petal of the lotus, mate. You think concrete is ugly. Who told you that? Why do you assume that?" It becomes like a little teaching to tell them how to get deeper. So with the Satipatthana, what you're doing is sustaining attention on one of these areas of like the body, like this Vedana, the mind or consciousness, the conscious objects. You do that long enough, then surprise, surprise, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, and it's tremendously empty. The whole body sort of starts to disappear. There's nothing there. And even like when you're meditating, you sustain attention, and just the body disappears. It's gone. It's nothing. Look at your breath. Sustain attention. It just disappears. Look at the doer. Sustain attention, and it disappears. Even samadhi nimitta, sustain attention, and it just disappears. Those amazing, like vanishing aspects to experience and to reality. You look at the carpet. The old carpet disappears and reveals a new carpet underneath. The outermost petals just vanish. That becomes one of the beautiful experiences in meditation, noticing the vanishing of phenomena. Things end, they're not constant. And this is the impermanence which I really like to stress. Not just rise and fall like a pendulum going to left to right, the ball is always there. Not like sort of a wave going up and down, because the water's always there. It's not just like movement. It's like existence and non-existence. Breaks up the continuity illusion. That's what anicca is supposed to do. And once you break the continuity illusion, then non-self becomes just so clear. Just no way can you hold on to that self anymore. It becomes obvious that was something you added onto reality. Just like frogs being sort of not tasty, or frogs being delicious. Actually, frogs are neither tasty nor delicious. It's just what you add on to it. The mind. Mind objects. Vedana. Or the body. It's what you add on to it. Makes it mind. Makes it a self. And that's where the problem of suffering lies, said the Buddha. Once you see that illusion, once you see that fundamental mistake in the way you look at the world and view the world, then the whole universe changes for you. You enter the street, Sotapanna. The whole thing changes. And with it, a whole heap of suffering disappears. That's why anyone who's seen the Dhamma is usually quite happy about it. They don't become miserable. People assume it's miserable. If you find out there's no one there, just what a depressing thing to experience. That's why I remember there was a cartoon I saw. I should have cut it out and kept it. Of a Blondie cartoon in the papers. You may know Blondie cartoon. And Dagwood. And Dagwood actually, in this cartoon, was actually sitting meditation in this office. And you know, in this American office. And his boss, this really cynical, sharp talking, quite sort of cruel boss, came in with his cigar and said, "What are you doing?" And Dagwood said, I'm trying to find myself. And the boss said, I wouldn't do it if I was you. If you found yourself, you'd be terribly disappointed. Sometimes you assume if we really, this is like the negative character, if we really found who we really are, we'd be sort of, you know, quite depressed about the discovery. It's best perhaps not to know, but that's not the way it goes. The thing is that if we really find out that there's no one in there, imagine, it's not what you imagine will occur, actually it becomes such a relief, such a freedom. Oh, thank goodness, I don't have to worry about me anymore. I don't have to care what people say about me anymore. I don't have to live up to all these ideals of people anymore. I don't have to achieve anymore. When you've got like a strong feeling of self, you have to justify this self. You have to be someone. You have to be a good meditator. You have to be a good person. You have to be jovial, charming, beautiful, wonderful. If you're an I, a self, even if there's no one in there, it doesn't matter anymore. People can call me whatever they like. I don't mind because I'm not here. I don't have to I don't have to live up to any ideals when I'm not here. So in this way you find that actually the realization of not self gives an incredible amount of freedom. So often that which has really been stressful for you in your life, a great burden, you'll find it's all connected with the illusion of self. Now the problems people have these days with lack of self-esteem, worrying about themselves, worrying about what people think of them, worrying about how they come across, worrying about how they're doing in life, how they're doing as a monk, how they're doing as an abbot, how they're doing as a meditator. Have you had a really good meditation retreat so far? Are you feeling complete and utter failure? How often is it in life if you're utter failures? It's marvellous if there's nothing there to fail or succeed. It doesn't matter. You can be completely at peace. You find that suffering can't touch you because there's nothing for it to touch. It's the freedom of that realisation. It's the freedom of suffering from seeing the root cause there. It's the illusion of a self. So this is like the Satipatthana and how it works, and it needs to have that prerequisite of powerful mindfulness and the ability to sustain attention, which is what we call samadhi. You apply it to any of these four areas and just see what happens, but be willing to suspend all of your old ideas. Be willing to see something new. Have the courage to throw away all your old bundles of hemp if you really want to see the beautiful priceless Dhamma right there in the centre of your lotus. So that's the talk on Satipatthana today. Anyone got any questions? You said that Satipatthana has been traditionally understood to be insight practice, and that's really not accurate to say so. That's a view or statement which has only been around for about 40-50 years. You're going back much earlier in Buddhist tradition, 2,500 years, and to the last 2,400 years before that. Satipatthana was not considered to be like pure insight practice. It wasn't differentiated from the other aspects of the Eightfold Path. Someone said today that the Satipatthana and Samasamadhi and every other aspect of the Eightfold Path, they dovetail together, inseparable. And certainly Satipatthana is not pure Vipassana, nor is it pure Samatha. It's just one aspect of one practice, one aspect of the same practice which we're all doing. That's why the Buddha always said that sort of there is only one path, no other, for the purity of insight. You know what that path is? Eightfold Path. That's the path which leads to enlightenment. That's the one path, the only path. And that's in the Dhammapada, which everyone knows because it says that in every other sort of place in the the Buddha's teachings. The way to end suffering, Four Noble Truths, the fourth noble truth, is the Eightfold Path. That is the way to end suffering. So it includes mindfulness, it includes samadhi, it also includes virtuous conduct, and all these other parts of the Eightfold Path. And you can't take out one aspect of the Eightfold Path and think it's the most important part and neglect all the others. Or even say any part of the Eightfold Path is unnecessary or you can do without it. And that is traditional Buddhism. There's even like one of the suttas there which is worthy of you looking at if you've got a copy of your Majjhima Nikaya, the Dantabhumi Sutta, where going through the gradual training, instead of the first jhana, they put the four satipatthanas, and then it goes second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. What's interesting is equating there the first jhana to satipatthanas, making it pure samatha. Sometimes it's put that way. But the point is, it's not really pure samatha, not pure vipassana. It depends on which particular way you practice the satipatthana. It includes everything. And when you use satipatthana for attaining jhanas, you use jhanas for attaining insight, for firming up satipatthana. The same way that you use jhanas for firming up your virtue, you use virtue for firming up your samadhi practice. Each one of these factors of the Eightfold Path, they support each other. And that's why that in your practice of the Dhamma, you should always look at which aspect of the Eightfold Path is weak. If one aspect is weak, then that's the one you should really sort of work to strengthen up. Because if you know it's the weak link in the chain is what sort of causes the problem, it's where the thing breaks. So in all those eight links of the Eightfold Path, if there's any one which is weak, then really work on that. If mindfulness, if the satipatthana is weak, then work on that. If samadhi is weak, jhanas are weak, then work on that. If effort is weak, then work on that. See which is a weak link and then build that one up. They support each other. Dear Ajahn, in the Goenka system of meditation, they use so-called feelings in the body and they sweep through the body and see that feelings in the body are always changing. Is this a mistaken interpretation of the second form of mindfulness? Could you kindly comment on this? Yeah, it is actually good to call that the second satipatthana, the second foundation of mindfulness, because the second foundation of mindfulness on awakening is very clearly just that aspect of conscious experience which is pleasurable or painful. You're just focusing not on where the sensation is or what type of sensation it is. You don't really ask or pay attention to whether it's hot or cold, or whether it's like pain or pleasure or tearing or cutting pain or whatever. All you're paying attention to is whether it's painful or whether it's pleasant. That's all. Just simplifying the perception down to that, because this is like the important part of experience which gives rise to craving, attachment, fear, suffering. Just the pleasurable or painful part of aspect of conscious experience. And that's what the Buddha especially wanted you to look at there, and to actually to somehow disassociate with that, or just to see it's just part of nature. Pleasure, pain, pain, pleasure. And that's with all the senses, beauty, ugliness, ugliness, beauty, sort of, delicious, sort of, what's the opposite of delicious taste? Terrible taste or whatever. These things, they always go together as pairs, rising and falling. When one disappears, the other one rises. When the second one disappears, the first one rises. It's constant play. And when you actually see it's part of nature, you actually can't avoid pain. You can't avoid ugliness. You can't avoid discomfort. It's part of life. And pleasure just comes whether you seek for it or not. You have delightful experience and you have terrible experiences, and this is part of life. You have nothing to do with about. You have no control over this. In fact, if you try and control it, you make it all worse. So when you actually see the pleasure and the pain, this Vedana, sort of this particular aspect of conscious existence, and just that particular aspect of conscious existence, you don't complicate it with other sort of labels and other sorts of considerations, then it gives a tremendous amount of insight and freedom from the tyranny of the pleasurable and the tyranny of the painful. You can be free from these things while you're still experiencing them. However, like sweeping through the body is more like body awareness. Really, it's the, I would actually class that more closely into the first Satipatthana. But it doesn't really matter which particular one it is. It's still a very useful technique, and it also, like I was saying, any sort of technique which is supposed to give insight also produces calm. And anyone who's done that technique will know that you go sweeping through your body, different parts of the body, just experiencing any sensations, feelings there, feelings in the English sense of the term, and you get very calm doing that, very peaceful, very concentrated, because you're sustaining your awareness, or you're training yourself to sustain your awareness on a limited area of existence, just the sensations in the body. You have to be present moment awareness, you have to be pretty much silent, you can't be thinking about all sorts of other things. You just have the words which are just describing the experience to yourself, that's all. So, because you're limiting your attention, and you're sustaining it on that limited area, then you get peaceful experiences. The mind starts to calm down. So that's why it becomes a very peaceful and calming experience. And to see that feelings in the body are always changing is a very superficial understanding of anicca. Sometimes that with Vedana, sometimes I've described it like the things on a television screen. You know, because the objects on the television screen are always changing. You know, you can even change channels. Just like with Vedana, you can change from sight to sound. Sound is channel 2, and smell is channel 3, taste is channel 4, the body is channel 5, and the mind is SBS, the interesting channel. Not that I would know, of course. This is what people tell me. But 6 channels which you've got. And the interesting thing is that in your television, we call like Vedana, there's always something on. And what we do in Samatha meditation is we turn the television off. So there's nothing on your screen at all. That's when it gets really interesting. So it's not just seeing the changing programs on there. With this meditation, going to cessation, is turning the whole television off. So Vedana ceases. It's interesting, it's only when we turn the television off, in the metaphor here, turn Vedana off, only then is there freedom from unpleasantness, when there's freedom from pleasantness as well. It's the only way you can get freedom from it. When you have a program on there, or any channel on, be the delightful and the undelightful. There's not one channel which is pure delight. Next question. In the suttas, the Buddha often appears to refute the notion that the body is self, because it cannot be controlled. It will get sick and die, whether we want it or not. However, it seems that in the jhanas, the mind becomes very malleable and is able to be controlled. Does this not suggest that the mind is self? It can suggest that the mind is self when you first get into these jhanas. The jhanas themselves aren't malleable. I may have sort of been spoken too loosely, because while you're in the jhanas, they're not malleable at all. They're just stuck. It's just the mind after jhanas becomes very malleable, and you can do all sorts of fun things with them, with that sort of mind after you've exited from the jhanas. And certainly when you're in the jhanas, you know, you can't be controlled. That's one of the things, because willpower ceases in jhanas, the doer is gone. So whenever you get into these jhanas, a strange experience that you're there, you're having great fun, but you just can't do anything. It's like you're frozen and you can't even sort of move your hand, as it were. I'm not saying you're aware of your body here, but you can't move any part of your mind. That which is called control, willpower, doing, is all completely disappeared. And that's why you're staying there a long time, because you can't even disturb it. You can't disturb yourself. So that's actually what happens in the jhana. So the jhana states, when you see this, it's very clear if you have the idea of self being having possessions, because this is one of the description of like a self, what the Buddha used, that if there is a self, there's something which belongs to the self, is possessions. And that, what you possess, you control. It's yours, and you have a right to control it. And if, like, the self doesn't own anything at all, if it doesn't possess anything, if it doesn't control anything, if it doesn't do anything, it's tantamount to not existing. Because to be is to do. You know, to exist is to control. If you don't control anything whatsoever, you're just like a brick in a wall, you're just like a rock on the ground, you're not doing anything, you're not alive, you're not a being, because you're not doing anything. You're lifeless. And so, in the jhanas, because you're not doing anything, it's very easy to see that this is cannot be a self, if you can look at it through that explanation. However, after you emerge from the jhanas, when the hindrances are gone, then the mind is very malleable. But you know how it works. You just point in a certain direction and the mind just goes on. It does seem to be able to be controlled, but only for a time, until the hindrances come back again, and only to a certain extent. So because it's not a permanent control, you can actually see that it cannot be belonging to a self. According to one teacher, there are three doors to stream entry: the door of anicca, dukkha and anatta. However, the Anattalakkhana Sutta lists these three: because things are anicca, they are dukkha, and because they are dukkha, they are anatta. Since anatta is unique to the Buddha's teaching, it seems that understanding this characteristic in relation to the other two makes one a stream enterer and not one characteristic by itself. Okay, the three characteristics, you know, of anicca, dukkha, anatta, is saying here that according to one teacher, there are three doors to stream entry: the door of anicca, the door of dukkha, and the door of anatta. Indeed, that these three ways of looking at existence, when you are actually penetrating the truth of existence, you can, as it were, go in through any one of these doors. But it's like when I was as a student working in the post office, in Christmas time, getting a bit of money. And in this post office in London, they had the letterboxes there, and letterboxes, three openings, and it had just London mail and inside the country but outside of London, and international mail, three little boxes there. And one day, because I'd finished the work I was doing there, they gave me the key and said, "You know, please empty the boxes here and bring it into the sorting room." And so I emptied the key and found that there were three separate letter boxes, but they all went into the same bin. It was a waste of time having these three separate. Whatever bin you put it in, whatever box you put it in, it all went into the same bin. And this is like sort of these three letter boxes here, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Whichever way actually you put the sort of mindfulness in, it all goes into the same bin inside. Because what is anicca, if you really see anicca properly, at the very same moment you see dukkha, you see anatta. Dukkha is unsatisfactoriness or suffering, anatta is non-self, if you truly see this. Because it's like three different sides of one triangle, and you know, you can't have a triangle with two sides, two like different facets of the same gem. They're not separate at all. They're not sort of separate self-existing entities. What is anicca is dukkha. What is dukkha is anicca. What is dukkha is anatta. What is anatta is anicca. However, in these three, that I often say that the hardest to see of these is anicca. But you always think it's the easiest one to see. That's why it's the hardest. Because anicca is the easiest to think that you know. And because you think you understand it, you see it clearly, you think you've completely covered it, it's the real anicca, the full anicca, is so difficult because it appears so easy. And I already mentioned, like, it's like the seeing the images on a TV screen. You can see them coming and going and coming and going. The characters are always changing, the programs are always ending, and the new ones coming up afterwards. But that's not the full meaning of anicca. You really see the full meaning of anicca when you don't just see the programs change, you see the programs end and the screen goes blank. There's no more programs on there. It's a different type of changing. It's not the characters change. It's not when one experience ends, another one appears immediately afterwards. It's all experience disappears. In fact, usually in that similar television screen, I say not just the programs go, but the whole television screen completely vanishes. Sunyata, emptiness, nothing there at all. So that's why anicca is very difficult for people to see. Because it's so easy to assume that you've seen it all. But things haven't really disappeared yet. The same with dukkha. Dukkha is the next easiest to see. It's in the middle, according to my classifications, because you can see much out there as dukkha. This is suffering, this is suffering, this is suffering. But there's always something one wishes to preserve as like happiness. Some little sort of niche. Some little corner of your inner room where you hang out, basically. Even though the whole world is suffering, just in here, this is nice. You always make some sort of little cozy nest inside. And you never dare to sort of say, that's dukkha. And it's actually finding that little thing. If you want to really find out what dukkha is and do that, investigation, don't go around saying, thinking, what is dukkha? Going around to say, what do I take as sukha? What do I take as happiness? Ease, comfort, peace. What do I assume is essential ease and happiness there? And when you see there's nothing there which you can rely upon. Because sometimes people think, well, in that enlightenment, then that's going to be sukha. That's actually the wrong type of enlightenment, which you understand there. That's why that sometimes people say, well, I'll become enlightened, I'm an arahat, then I'll be okay. Again, one of my favorite teachings is in the Bhikkhuni Sangyutta from Sister Wajira, an arahat, who was approached by this fellow called Mara, and she said very clearly that she would describe what it's like to be an arahat. You know, what it actually feels like inside to be an arahat, to be fully enlightened. You know how she described it? The most beautiful way of describing the experience of being an arahat. Dukkha arising and dukkha passing away. More dukkha arising, dukkha passing away. That's the experience of being an arahat. The difference between that and an ordinary human being is I'm experiencing dukkha. However, the arahat also knows that dukkha is about to end. Because when their life ends, when the five khandhas disappear, so does dukkha. That's called parinibbana, complete cessation. As other arahats said, it's like a workman waiting for their wages. You've done the work, you've got to wait for your paycheck. That's what an arahat is like. You know you've done the work, it's all ended, the cause for dukkha has been completely eradicated, uprooted, abandoned. The cause for rebirth, be completely uprooted, abandoned. Like a workman waiting for their wages. When this body dies, then you get your wages. Really beautiful. That's why people, it's very difficult to see dukkha. Because we think, well, at least being an arahat should be fun. What am I doing this all for anyway, if just being an arahat is dukkha as well? Well, there we go. Dukkha is very hard to see. It's the Buddha actually said that he gave these beautiful quotes of sabbe sankhara anicca, like all conditioned things are impermanent. And sometimes people, they look at the last word anicca, they look at the second word sankhara, conditioned things, but they never look at the first word. Or everything, the whole works, the whole caboodle. And that's what they don't understand. Or if people think most is dukkha, then they're not enlightened. And they say all. All is anicca, all is dukkha, all is anatta. So we always like to think there's something there which is outside of all of this, which we can sort of hang out in. And same as anatta. Anatta is the easiest one to penetrate because it's so uncompromising. It's so clear in theory. You can't get around it. These other ones you can get around and think you understand it or think you've penetrated it when you haven't. But anatta, if you think you've understood anatta, then you probably have. If you think you've got it, then it's almost definite you have. So anatta is like, you know, non-self, which I've been talking a lot about. There's no one in there. So anatta is unique to the Buddhist's teaching. So is all things of dukkha is unique to the Buddhist teachings. Other teachings, there's always some place, some heaven world, some cosmic consciousness, some place you can get reborn into where you can be happy ever after. The fact that all is dukkha is unique to Buddhism. The same as the place which you can get reborn into, the heaven realm, pure land, or the realm of cosmic consciousness, or uniting with the ground of all being, that is also permanent. That's why all the other religions also different on the extent of impermanence. Only in the Buddha Dhamma is impermanence complete. So anicca, dukkha, anatta, it's only in Buddhism that each one of these is unique to Buddhism. Anicca, dukkha in their extent, and anatta in their extent as well. Because even like in Christianity, they have like different levels of self. And they say, yeah, I mean the ego, sort of, yeah, that's non-self. But sort of God, that's your real self. Or cosmic consciousness, that's the real me, but it's ordinary consciousness, yeah, I can understand that's not the real me. So they've all got teachings of anatta in a sense. You know, the lower self, and allow that to merge with God, or merge with a higher self, or the Atman into the Paramatman, or the Brahmin. But the Buddha says that complete anicca, complete dukkha, complete anatta. That's why it's so powerful. It's also so frustrating because people just, please give me a little bit of some permanence, just a little bit of happiness, please. Just a little bit where I can have permanent happiness and also be there to enjoy it. Because that's what I really want. And that's the problem. So if you really penetrate any of these, the other ones come as a course. And that is why that in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the Buddha sort of says, because he it starts with the clear impermanence of the senses, the six senses. Once you actually see them, and because they are impermanent, he says they're suffering, they're dukkha. And it's interesting because he says all types of things which you see, you hear, you smell, you taste, you touch, you cognize with the mind, all everywhere, far and inside, outside, refined and gross, far and near, all everywhere, is anicca, dukkha, anatta. Same with all consciousness. The Buddha is just so sort of clear about this, saying over and over and over again, just quite frankly, it's quite clear what the Buddha was pointing to. There's not sort of a cosmic consciousness or a little sort of flaw in this sort of system, not this little place where you can escape the consequences of these teachings. So if you actually start from anicca, impermanence, see just a whole lot is anicca, it follows. But it's not going to be sort of happiness. Because if it's anicca, it's even the degree of happiness is changing. If you have a lot of happiness and then less happiness, the less happiness becomes suffering.